It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we just heard what may be the final public hearing from the U.S. House Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. We'll break down what we learned and talk about where the committees work, and a subpoena of the former president goes next. First, a few school districts across Wisconsin are creating policies that restrict teachers' ability to call students by their preferred pronouns or preferred names without parental permission. At school board meetings, some parents have argued that they have a right to know about big issues facing their kids. Others have said it could put students in vulnerable positions and possibly at risk if their home environment is not supportive. Kids are often in the middle of these political and educational debates, but what does this all mean for their health and well-being? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has this been a debate, an issue in your own local school district? Is it something that's affected you personally as a student, a parent, a teacher? Love to hear your thoughts on this, what you're seeing. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. L.B. Klein is an assistant professor in the School of Social Work at UW-Madison, specializing in gender-based violence prevention, survivor advocacy, and LGBTQ plus health. L.B., thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into some of the specific issues involved here, the fact that they become issues, political issues, very heated arguments at school boards and in protests, do you worry that the interests of the students themselves are sometimes getting lost in the shuffle?
I do. It can be so challenging for a lot of the really amazing trans and gender expansive youth in our state and across the country who are standing up for themselves, for every one of those students who is testifying or showing up in a space, and for their parents. There are many more who don't feel safe doing so. And so I do worry about that.
One of the big questions that school boards are facing, and this has come up in a few different districts around Wisconsin, is, okay, what happens when a student comes to a teacher or a counselor or whatever and says, I would like to be referred to by a particular pronoun, a different name than my given name, and then what does the school do about that? Some policies say, go for it, don't contact the parents. Some of the newer policies saying, yeah, you got to contact the parents. Can you talk about what's at stake for that kid who's making that request?
Absolutely. So for kids who are getting to the point where they're telling someone about their name and the personal pronouns they'd like to use, they've already probably gone through a lot of really challenging steps to realize that for themselves. We know that a lot of, for transgender and gender diverse young people, that they're at an increased risk of trauma, assault, depression, suicide, and homelessness. And so there's a real fear around talking to adults about being a trans or gender diverse young person. And so they're already in a place where they're probably feeling vulnerable because, as you mentioned, there's a lot of divisiveness over their ability to navigate the world as themselves, as their full selves. And so that is a huge issue for young people. And teachers, we know, have a huge opportunity to support students that many trans and gender diverse adults really specify that teachers and schools, that those specific people who helped them and supported them, who use their names, who use their pronouns, help to enhance their long-term well-being. So we know that there's a huge impact when we have 75% of trans young people, for example, who feel unsafe because of their gender expression in schools. Those teacher lifelines are crucial.
Now, we've heard from some board members who vote for policies saying you got to contact the parents in these cases, saying, well, you know, parents have an interest in big stuff facing their kids. If their grades were slipping, parents would want to know. If they're getting bullied at school, parents would want to know. Why wouldn't the school be obliged to let parents know, hey, your kid is making this request of us?
Yeah, as a parent myself, I really understand that parents would want to know what's going on with their children. On a broader level, though, what I think about too is that there are many trans and gender diverse young people who don't have supportive people at home. That we know that in the short term, many trans and gender diverse people, only about a third of them, young people, feel that their parents are supportive of them. And in the longer term, across their lifespan, it only really goes up to about a half. We have incredibly elevated rates of homelessness for young people, about 40% of the 4 million youth experiencing homelessness are LGBTQ, when LGBTQ people broadly are about 10% of the population, and trans and gender diverse people are only about 1-2% of the population. So a lot of overrepresentation there, and some of that comes from rejection by family. So the consequence of experiencing assault, homelessness, additional harm related to that lack of affirmation at home and at school has real consequences for young people.
We're talking to social work professor L.B. Klein from UW-Madison, looking at school policies, especially those that regard transgender students and other LGBT issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think a school's policy should be in that case where a student says, I want to be referred to by a different pronoun, a different name? Should the school staff be required to contact parents? Why or why not? What do you think? Is this something that you're seeing in your own school district, your own school, maybe your own family? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Another issue that has come up, LB, is pride flags in schools. For example, the Kettle Moraine School Board says, hey, faculty and staff, you can't display political or religious messages. Included in that, they've said pride flags displayed prominently or openly, say, in a classroom or a hallway or things like that. What do you think of the pride flag falling into that wider political or religious ban on political or religious material?
When I think about trans and gender diverse young people, many young people in general, but trans and gender diverse young people especially, aren't trying to be political. They're trying to fit in. It is hard enough to navigate school. And what things like pride flags or using pronouns in an email signature or providing information about trans and gender diverse people does is it allows these young people to feel like they have somewhere to go. They have somewhere that they can feel safe. And we want for all young people, for them to not only feel safe, but to thrive. But for basic level safety, it can be really valuable to display support of those students, because in many contexts of their lives, they're not experiencing that support. And some recent research suggests to us that the more domains like school, work, peers, home life, that LGBTQ young people, especially trans young people, feel supported for who they are, the less likely they're going to experience suicidality, depression, anxiety, trauma that many young people are experiencing who are trans and gender diverse.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Miles is with us in Green Bay. Miles, hi. Are you there, Miles? I think, Miles, you're on the air. Go for it.
Oh, sorry about that. I guess my thought as someone who's working their way toward being a teacher is just like within the field of education, getting buy-in from students and having them see value and a place for themselves within school is just one of the most important things that you can do just to be able to have kids learning in the classroom. And I just think, you know, using a pronoun that a kid wants or a name that they want, especially if you can tell that they're genuine, that that's like something that's meaningful to them. What an easy way to get kids to buy in and feel valued at school. And like, I don't know how there could be people in the field of education that would see it any other way. Cause I mean,
Miles, thanks for sharing your experience as a teacher in training. What do you think, LB?
You know, when I think about future teachers like Miles, they're really talking about that basic piece around student privacy and affirming who they are. What I want for teachers are training around gender support plans, professional development opportunities to learn about these issues. Because there's a lack of training in education programs, sometimes teachers like Miles might not know what to do. And also we need trans and trans affirming teacher colleagues for Miles in schools who can be role models and support to students. So I very much feel Miles on that.
Thanks for the call, Miles. We're talking L.B. Klein, assistant professor in the School of Social Work at UW-Madison, looking at school policies limiting the usage of students' preferred pronouns and how those kind of decisions can affect students. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you want to see your local school, say, handling these kind of issues? Has this been a heated debate in your community? Are you a kid who's affected by this or a parent thereof? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with L.B. Klein, assistant professor in the School of Social Work at UW-Madison. We're looking at school policies related to transgender and LGBT students in general, things like how schools handle requests to change pronouns for a student, whether pride flags can be posted in schools. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. A concern, I think, LB, as we see some states passing laws, Florida most notably, is I think from advocates saying, okay, if we're posting pride flags, for example, are we introducing kids to the concept of same-sex relationships? Are we advocating for them? Some parents not liking that possibility. What do you think about that concern?
Sure. When I think about policy, I think a lot about the studies of state-level policies, that if we have fewer anti-LGBTQ state policies, and there are 13 states that have non-discrimination laws that specify transgender diverse students, Wisconsin is not one of them, that we see that with fewer anti-LGBT policies, that there's greater reuse of correct name and pronoun, and we have better outcomes for trans students. So we know that more affirming policies lead to better outcomes for these kids. And we also know that if we have those restrictions on being able to support trans students, that we're seeing more of those deleterious outcomes, such as suicidality, depression, anxiety, trauma, assault, and discrimination from their peers and others in the community.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. John joins us now in McGregor, Iowa. John, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, what did you want to tell us about, John?
I discussed this not in detail with a member. I'm retired. Member of our school district, and there's a real concern that there are some kids who are not really in the transgender and are asking for the pronouns like that, and it's causing teachers or counselors, et cetera, kind of angst over a real feeling that this is something they should contact a parent about. And I really understand what you're saying about there are times that you have a large number of families that are going to come against this. But my feeling is, should there be some kind of testing that's not invasive to make sure that these kids truly are transgender and really do require to have their telephone number and their parents not called?
And John, I want to ask, just to get a sense from what you're hearing from your former colleagues, is it that students are doing this on a lark or as a joke, or that they're confused and not sure if they're transgender? Like, what kind of, I guess, confusion are you hearing from your former colleagues?
I haven't been able to discuss it in big detail,
sure.
But it's, I think it seems to her it's a joke.
Mm-hmm.
Or is my former colleague, it's a joke.
Gotcha. John, thanks for the call. LB, I guess, should there be some kind of effort to say, okay, this kid is really sincere or genuine in their request, say, to have a different pronoun?
So I think that if we have affirming teachers, students will have spaces to have conversations about their gender. Being a young person, I think for all of us, was confusing in so many ways. And that's why you have supportive adults who can help guide you and provide support. What I would say is that I would always err on the side of believing and supporting trans and gender diverse young people, that we know that certainly gender can be fluid, Certainly there are people who question their gender that end up coming to a variety of conclusions, but we need to create that space for folks to do so from a loving and supportive place, and not a place that involves saying, this is wrong, this is something that you shouldn't do. And by allowing people to express themselves for the gender that they are, we're creating opportunities for folks to really come to terms with what that looks like for them and what gender means to them without judgment. And when I think about what judging students might look like in these instances, students who are affirmed and supportive, who maybe they think, well, actually, I'm not trans or gender diverse, can then change their mind in a way that feels supportive. But students who are trans and gender diverse and aren't supportive have these incredibly huge consequences, including suicidality, including assault, harassment, abuse, that we don't want those students to experience.
John, thanks a lot for that call. In our last just half a minute or so, LB, what are you hoping schools will be thinking about as these issues come up at, say, school board meetings?
You know, I would hope that schools are thinking about the consequences of any actions that they take to their students, and that they would look into the guidance from the Department of Education and Office of Civil Rights, which provides really useful tools on how to support all students, and especially trans and gender diverse students, that there are tools out there and information to help guide decision making. Because what we all want, I think, despite some misunderstanding sometimes about trans and gender diverse young people and who they are and what that might look like, because a lot of folks don't know, we all want safe and thriving young people. And there are ways for us to do that for trans and gender diverse students.
LB, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's LB Klein, Assistant Professor of Social Work at UW-Madison. We looked at school policies related to transgender students. When the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, it ended access to virtually all abortions here in Wisconsin. Since then, the state has seen protests, campaign ads, and new political groups aimed at organizing people who believe the state's 1849 abortion ban is too restrictive. In a closely divided swing state, the future of that law could come down to a relatively small number of undecided voters, Rob Mentzer reports.
For Democrats running for office this year, the calculation is simple. They believe their position on abortion rights is popular, and the Republican Party's anti-abortion views are unpopular. In the race for governor, Democrat Tony Evers has launched new ads that say Republican Tim Michaels would force a 12-year-old who is raped to give birth. It's a likely reference to Michaels' position when he ran for U.S. Senate in 2004. Michaels was asked then about such a scenario on WPR's regional talk show Route 51. He began by saying he couldn't think of a worse crime than the rape of a 12-year-old.
But I think in the end, what I would try and tell them is, you know, there's a life in there, a life that was created by God. And if you carry that baby full term, there'll be 25 or 35 couples that will be there willing and ready to adopt that baby and love it and raise it as their own.
Michael's 2004 answer is a marker of how deeply held his anti-abortion views are. But 2022 is a different world than 2004. Then, abortion was legal in Wisconsin. The example was hypothetical. Neither of those things is true anymore. Late last month, Michaels changed his position, saying he would not veto a bill that added exceptions for rape and incest to Wisconsin's abortion ban. A Michaels campaign spokesperson pointed to the candidate's recent statements and said the WPR appearance was nearly 20 years old. The U.S. Supreme Court's decision in June to overturn the right to abortion access was a generational victory for conservatives, but politically, it seems to have helped Democrats. The Marquette University Law School poll found more than 80% of Wisconsin voters believe rape and incest exceptions should be allowed. About 60% of voters and two-thirds of independent voters say Roe v. Wade should never have been overturned.
It's fine for 50 years, and then you wake up one morning and now it's not legal.
That's Jill Reesley. The 71-year-old from Cudahy identifies as an independent, and she's voted for Republicans in the past, not this year.
If any woman in this state votes Republican, They are totally out of their minds.
Riesley was one of more than 100 Wisconsin voters who told WPR's Wisconsin Main Street Agenda Project that abortion was her most important voting issue in the midterms. WPR interviewed 5 women who said they were politically independent or who leaned Republican.
The government should not be involved. I don't want a politician making decisions that I should be making with my healthcare provider.
More than just abortion being medical care, it's also about people having the right to make their own choices in their lives.
I actually feel ashamed that we let our young women down.
That was Jean Bartz of Baraboo, Michelle Johnson of Sullivan, and Mary Fuller of Appleton. None of them identifies herself as a Democrat, but they all say this is the issue that will decide their votes this year. Mary Kate Lazat is a political scientist at Augusta University in Georgia. She studies gender gaps in politics. She says abortion is not one of the issues where there's a pronounced difference between women's and men's views. But
Republicans in general are much more likely than Democrats to disagree with their party on abortion, on overturning Roe.
And that's why Lazat thinks women who hold somewhat conflicted views on the issue really could reshape the electorate.
Even if they don't identify as pro-choice or have always identified as weakly pro-life, there's a lot of people who are not going to be in favor of a complete lack of access.
Wisconsin is a closely divided state, and races for governor and U.S. Senate are tightly contested. Most voters say inflation and economic concerns are more important to them than abortion rights. But for Democrats, the state's political future may hinge on whether abortion is the issue that can make independent voters swing their way. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, a political scientist joins the show to talk about today's hearing in Congress on the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol and questions about whether the committee will recommend charges, plus the vote to subpoena former President Trump to get documents and to answer questions. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a New York Times critic joins the show to share her love of nerd culture and to talk about why she thinks it deserves the same kind of cultural analysis given to, say, theater or a big novel. Now, the U.S. House Committee investigating the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol held what could be its final public hearing earlier this afternoon. The hearing ended with the committee's most aggressive step yet, voting to subpoena former President Donald Trump. They also reviewed what the investigation has turned up so far and shared new evidence that suggested Trump knew he had lost the 2020 election, including a clip of former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson recalling a conversation she heard between Trump and former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows.
So he had said something to the effect of, "I don't want people to know we lost, Mark. This is embarrassing. Figure it out. We need to figure it out. I don't want people to know that we lost."
There are still unanswered questions like whether any high-profile political officials will face legal charges for their actions related to January 6th, including former President Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to what you heard today? Do you want to see the committee make criminal recommendations? Do you think former President Trump should testify? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, I want to start at the end now with that unanimous vote to subpoena the former president. Here's Republican Representative Liz Cheney, vice chair of the Select Committee, talking just before the vote.
We are obligated to seek answers directly from the man who set this all in motion. And every American is entitled to those answers so we can act now to protect our republic.
This is the big takeaway in a lot of ways. What do you make of that subpoena?
It's a pretty bold move, but first off, to point out, remember, he's no longer president of the United States. and he can't claim executive privilege and say that he doesn't want to show up to testify. Now, he could show up, claim the fifth, but I think what's really being set up at this point is a challenge. The committee is challenging the president to now say, show up and make your case to the American public, make your case to us. And I think they're doing this to give him an opportunity to perhaps, I don't know, just again, make his case. And I think also they want to do this if in fact they make any recommendations for criminal prosecution, they're giving the president or the ex-president one last time to speak for himself.
As we've seen with other requests and in some cases subpoenas from this committee, there are ways to stall in courts, ways to challenge their authority to do that. This could be a long legal process if they pursue this.
There's no question about it. And I think it's unlikely that we would see the president testifying at least before the January. And I say that because the legal proceedings will get dragged out for a while. And then depending on what the composition of Congress looks like and the partisan control after the November elections, any subpoena may very well be moot because if there's a shift from Democratic to Republican control of Congress, it's unlikely that this committee will exist or that if it does, that it will pursue that subpoena anyhow.
Do you see any likelihood that we would see the former president talking to this committee between now and when that new Congress is sworn in?
I'm very skeptical about it, even though it does give the president an opportunity to be able to make his case to the American public. Remember, he'd have to do so under oath. And if he were to do so under oath and he's subject to, you know, issues of perjury, I think he could do just as effective of the job talking the way he does right now, especially to his supporters, without showing up. So I expect him, as he's done with everything else, to fight. I mean, in fact, today we just got news that the Supreme Court has turned down one of the ex-president's requests regarding the Mar-a-Lago. Trump will resist this subpoena also.
Looking at what we heard from the committee today, a lot of this had to do with timeline. When were plans put in place? What did the president know and when did he know it? Days before the election, a memo and public statements about plans to claim victory on election night, even before the count was done. Examples of the former attorney general, Bill Barr, saying, yeah, I told the president this Dominion thing was a fantasy theory. And then the president days later stating publicly what he had just been told wasn't true. How important was establishing that timeline, do you see, in today's hearing?
I think the timeline and establishing it was very important for a lot of reasons. One, what it speaks to, again, if I can sort of speak as a law professor who thinks about criminal law too, it speaks to criminal intent. It indicates that the president laid out plans to intend to do certain types of acts, that is to either tell the vice president, you know, to nullify the electoral vote or to come up with fake electors or for states to manufacture votes. It speaks to the president having laid this out for a while, and that becomes critical to making any type of criminal case. It also speaks to the fact, as we heard several times today, that the president knew. The president was advised by Barr and by others he had lost the election, that there were no stolen votes, there was no widespread voter fraud, and he chose to disregard. So if I can use the word for today or for now, intentional or willful, they were speaking to the state of mind of what Donald Trump knew and for how long that he knew it as the election was unfolding and then after the election as the recounts were going on.
Talking to David Schultz, law professor at the University of Minnesota, about today's January 6th committee hearing. Likely last public hearing of that committee, ending with a subpoena issued for former President Trump. You can join in with your reactions to what you saw or heard today, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Willem joins us now in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. Well, the most frightening thing I heard was the law professor's assertion or someone that when the Republicans, if they take over the Congress, that this would all go away, that a historic event, no president has ever tried to do this. So anyway, the reason I was calling was because I think from my personal experience, I'm an immigrant to this country. I've always been told about American exceptionalism, how this is a country of laws and not men, and no man is above the law and equal justice for everyone. That's what people always told me about America. And I moved here with my family in the late 1950s. Both my parents survived World War II in the Netherlands. My father was in a concentration camp for 3 years. He was in the Dutch resistance. His brother was executed by the Nazis. My mother was in prison for handing out anti-Nazi leaflets. So they instilled in me the importance of the truth and how bad things happen. When, you know, Abraham Lincoln, in a quote, said, "Tell the people the truth and the nation will be safe."
Willem, thanks for the call. David Willem, I think trying to lay out what's at stake here, do you think that something as fundamental as Willem is talking about, the concept of, nobody being above the law, is at stake here?
I think that's part of what's at stake, but I think also what's at stake is the reputation of the United States as a democracy across the world. You know, I teach abroad quite a bit, and I was over in Lithuania recently, and the world is watching us, you know, that we want to claim to be the world's greatest democracy, the leader in democracy. And to see what happened on January 6th, I think not just shocked Americans, but the rest of the world. And they're looking to see what we're going to do next. You know, other countries in the world hold their elected leaders, including their presidents or prime ministers, responsible when they violate the law. And so in many ways, this hearing is a referendum on American democracy, and not just in terms of how we operate internally, but in terms of the message that we are sending to the rest of the world. And I mention this because this caller is talking about thinking about America as the perspective of an immigrant turned American citizen. And so he captures really well kind of these dual images of how the world and how Americans themselves are viewing these hearings.
Thanks for the call, Willem, at 800-642-1234. A lot of focus, David, today on former President Trump's speech at the Ellipse, where he ultimately called on people listening to march to the Capitol. Premeditated, apparently, according to emails from the organizers, there were plans for him to spontaneously call for this. That said, is that illegal? Is this free speech? So the president can say what he wants?
Well, this is interesting because we've heard for over a year now people saying the president was just exercising his free speech rights and what he was doing there. I think what the hearing did today was really quite interesting in terms of establishing the fact that the president, again, knew that the claims of voter fraud were false. He appeared to know that the demonstrators were dangerous, knew what their plans were in terms of marching to the Capitol. And the reason why I mention this, there's a famous U.S. Supreme Court case called Brandenburg versus Ohio. And it draws the line between free speech and when something is not speech. And what the court said is when you say something that advocates imminent lawlessness, that's imminent. That's no longer protected speech. If everything that we heard today was correct, what the president said and what he did on January 6th crossed the line from constitutionally protected speech to some form of what? Inciting of a riot. And if that's accurate, the president is now potentially liable for whatever the federal laws that would be in place for not just interfering with a federal proceeding, but also in terms of what? Perhaps, again, if I could use that phrase, inciting a riot or inciting destruction. He bears responsibility, if the committee's correct, for the rioters and what they did.
We're talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, with us today to look back at what we learned in today's January 6th hearing. Could be the last televised hearing from the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you learn from the January 6th hearings today and in the past? What questions are still unanswered as far as you know? What is your reaction? What do you want to see come out of all this? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about today's hearing for the House Committee investigating January 6th. David Schultz from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota stays with us, and you can join in too at 800-642-1234. Have you followed the hearings? What has been the most surprising to you? What do you wish you know that we still don't know? What do you hope comes out of all of this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls with Mike in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hi. I was wondering if the professor knows of any state laws that have been created in the wake of the former president taking advantage of norms or precedents of the past and loopholes or gray areas, such as requiring the filing of tax documents for any federal offices that they may want to run for in order to be placed on ballots, or any similar type of tightening of regulations.
Mike, thanks for the call. I remember hearing some states were looking at that particular idea. David, have we seen that or other state laws, Mike is wondering, in the aftermath of January 6th that you see as significant?
Well, the Brennan Center in New York has documented in general across what, 42 or 43 states, nearly 500 laws aimed at trying to change election rules, for example. There's been some states that are trying to both, let's say, tighten the law, and some, you might say, loosen the law in terms of, let's say, voting requirements. But in general, I think where the caller is going is in terms of maybe, I think what I'm hearing here, actions about January 6th. In terms of criminal laws, I think all the states have pretty clear language there regarding things such as inciting of a riot, things like that. But if we're talking about also adding qualifications for running for office, mm-hmm. states have leeway to do that for their own state offices, but the federal constitution pretty much limits the ability of states to be able to add things. For example, I know many people were concerned that the president, for example, Trump, never released his tax records. And they're saying, well, maybe there ought to be laws that require that. It's just not clear as a matter of constitutional law if states could now say, as a condition of appearing on the ballot in our state, a person would have to release, running for president, their tax returns. But I know states have talked with this. And so I'll say that it's a mixed bag in terms of what we've seen since January 6th. And not a surprise, there's a partisan divide out there in terms of how states and legislatures have reacted to January 6th.
Mike, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. One possible legal change at the federal level that may be in the works. We've, I think, talked about this before, David. The process by which Congress and the vice president certify the electoral vote. President Trump thought to then Vice President Pence could block particular slates of electors. Everybody else seemed to disagree, including Vice President Pence himself. Can you talk about the latest on the efforts to clarify and take out any confusion about how that works?
Sure. If we look at the U.S. Constitution itself, there is no role for Congress in terms of second guessing the states on their electoral votes. The only role that Congress has is if a candidate for president does not get the majority of electoral votes, then the House gets to pick the president. But until then, no role. After a couple of disputed elections after the Civil War, what was called the Electoral Vote Count Act was adopted as a way for Congress to try to resolve disputes in let's say, questions about which electoral votes to seek from a particular state. But at no point did that act say that the vice president or Congress had the authority to just nullify electoral votes. The legislation before Congress right now, which is getting bipartisan support, and I should point out that Mitch McConnell supports it as well as Democrats support it, and many Republicans, would clarify and say that Congress has, at best, I'm going to say, a ceremonial role, or maybe a master's of ceremonial role. The vice president, who, when he presides or she presides over the counting of the electoral votes, it's merely ceremonial. There is no substantive power to say, I accept or reject. I want to say it's the equivalent of what? It's somebody at a contest opening up something and saying, and the winner is, you know, like I'm trying to think about the Academy Awards. And the Electoral Vote Count Act reauthorization will make that very, very clear.
Let's go back to our callers. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. I was listening to the hearing earlier today, and I think it might be an odd quirk of history that the reason Ron Johnson didn't object to Wisconsin electoral votes is because Nancy Pelosi was trying to negotiate with Mitch McConnell to speed up the hearing and basically get get the Republicans who are going to object to not have as many objections. So basically, I think one of the things I heard her say is could they limit it to one state if they are going to object to a state's electoral votes being counted, which would be an odd quirk of history. They very definitely, according to the testimony we heard, had guns in that crowd. So that's something else that was interesting compared to what Mr. Johnson said. Also, the deep state that Trump loved to complain about, kind of wondered if the deep state, the real one, was if Trump was trying to build one within the government for this event.
Nate, thanks for the call. That first point, it was footage we hadn't seen before of Speaker Pelosi and others trying to quarterback a response and get this vote to happen that night. And he's referring to that negotiations like, can you just object to Arizona and then let this thing get done?
No, you're absolutely correct. I mean, at some point, I think Congress was, I mean, everybody in Congress was shell-shocked at what happened that day, and they wanted to get their work done. Pelosi did, McConnell did, the vice president did. And so there was a lot of negotiations on January 6th. How do we actually move this forward so it wouldn't get dragged out? Because also, it's already January 6th. We're what, within 14 days of the new president being sworn in. So yes, there were things that they had to, that they said they had to do that night, and they wanted to figure out ways so that it wouldn't get dragged out even further, because they also didn't know at that time, were there going to be more rioters? Were they still in danger or not?
Thanks for that call, Nate. Nate also wondering who else in the Trump administration is getting attention from this congressional committee and maybe in the future from the Justice Department who might have gone along with this, who might have obstructed investigations into it. What kind of things are you watching for, David?
Well, we know that at one point Mark Meadows was subpoenaed, didn't show up. He's probably somebody who's going to be looked at, as well as we heard references to Trump's possible selections of a new attorney general. You know, in the waning days, I'm looking to see people like that. We already know that Steve Bannon, who is no longer part of the administration, has been looked at. So I think we're going to be looking at some of his senior advisors who were there. And we shouldn't forget that in earlier hearings, this committee was also looking at other members of Congress who might have been in consultation with the President of the United States. And I'll be curious to see how all that unfolds.
And in just our last couple of minutes, the big question here is, of course, this is a congressional committee. They can't arrest people. They can't charge people with crimes. The Justice Department can. What are you watching for there to see if they will pursue the evidence the committee presented, the evidence they've gathered themselves, and might be charging higher ups involved in this?
I think that's exactly the issue. If I can tie it back to something from before also, if Trump refuses to show up also to Congress, Congress could issue a contempt of Congress and ask the Justice Department to also hold the ex-president in contempt of court, which could be criminal. And what we're looking at here is, even if that doesn't happen, at some point this report goes to the Justice Department, and Merrick Garland, who's the Attorney General and the Justice Department, has to make a decision. Do they believe there's enough evidence here to indict probably the ex-president or maybe any members of his circle? And that's what I'm going to be looking to see as this committee, if it holds any more hearings, but more importantly, in its final report, does it make the conclusion? Does it render the conclusion that the president should be charged? That's what we're really looking for here, is to see. And this will stand potentially in contrast to what a few years ago, the Mueller report, which had looked at whether or not the president and his administration, the president and his campaign, was doing anything in terms of trying to illegally interfere with the conduct of the 2016 elections.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University and of law at the University of Minnesota. He's with us today to talk about what we learned in today's hearing on the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol, what could be the last public hearing in this series, though the investigation is still going on, and a look at where the investigation goes next. If you still have questions that might be fodder for a future show, you can always email us with what you want to know that we don't know yet. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. And hey, speaking of questions you have, how about your kids? Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson joins the program to answer kids' questions about the midterm elections here in Wisconsin. If you have a kid, if they have a question, email said question, ideas@WPR.org, and maybe Kate will be able to ask Sean about that. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. I've talked on the show about the time machines of Wisconsin. Now, there's probably a divide when I say that. Some of you might think it's some weird science fiction thing. Others remember the ATM machines with the brand Time, T-Y-M-E, for Take Your Money Everywhere. Now, that brand of ATM is long gone, but it might be making a comeback. As reported by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Landmark Credit Union, they're based in Brookfield, and they're bringing the Time Machine brand back. Took them a while, I gather, to get the rights to do that, but they thought it was worth it to bring back a throwback concept. Hopefully the new Time machines will be conveniently located near a bubbler to make the Wisconsin experience complete. Time keeps on slipping into the future. This is Central Time with an eye.